song is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2022 Walter Magazine. We begin with The Circuit, Creativity and Friendly Competition at the Kirby Derby by Emma Ginsberg. The Kirby Derby soapbox race is a time-honored tradition in Pullen Park Terrace, a small neighborhood formed by Kirby Street and the adjoining Bellevue Street. On the night before the Derby, when everyone's out building their cars, you can carry your drink with you from house to house and have a very social evening, says Chris Delano, a Pullen Park resident and the Derby's official/unofficial MC. Every year since 2002, residents, friends, and curious Raleighites don costumes and line the street to watch the annual event. Hand-built, gravity-powered cars, disguised as everything from sharks to cake slices, barrel downhill to the tune of cheering neighbors, all racing for the Kirby Cup. Some cars wipe out early on. Others are surprisingly fast. Many creations are there less to race than to be seen, eye-catching spectacles that draw oohs and ahs from fans as they amble past. Kirby Street may be small, but the Kirby Derby is a huge showcase of residents' creativity. It's a celebration of community. It's just an event full of family and fun, run by people who are very passionate about it, says Pullen Park resident Danielle Teed. Ali and Beth Khalifa led planning efforts for the first celebration, a simple parade of homemade floats. The crowd-drawing soapbox race and pine car derby for younger auto engineers didn't become part of the event until the tradition's seventh year. People were hemming and hawing about how it was called a derby, but there was no race, so we just kind of added one. And that's how we wound up where we are, says Delano. The Kirby Cup, the trophy that would eventually be awarded to race victors, entered the picture serendipitously. A friend of a friend bought the trophy at a yard sale as a gift, and then it got passed on to me, says Delano. We had plates put on it, and now the winner gets their name added to it every year. For 15 years, the Derby took place right on Kirby Street, where a sharp turn they call Dead Man's Curve caused crashes that became the stuff of legends, and spectators mingled while drifting out in and out of residents' yards. It was an invite-only event to keep it small and neighborhood-focused. We asked media who wanted to write stories about the Derby to do it after the event, says Delano. Then one year, the Friday before the race, we were on the front page of the paper. The crowds weren't too bad, and Pullen Park Terrace has had a change of heart in recent years. Now, we tell people to tell anybody and everybody they talk to about the Derby, says Delano. We want it to be as big as possible. Today's Kirby Derby is a full-blown festival, complete with local food trucks, with the planning effort still fearlessly led by the Khalifas. Though drivers from around Raleigh can now compete in the soapbox race for the Kirby Cup, the People's Choice Neighborhood Trophy goes to a Pullen Park Terrace resident as a reminder of the place at the heart of it all. By 2017, the event had gained so much traction that it was moved to nearby Dorothea Dix Park to accommodate growing crowds. I don't feel like it being in Dix Park takes away from the neighborhood vibe because we're still planning the Derby together, says Teed. The Derby was canceled due to Hurricanes Florence and Michael in 2018 and COVID concerns in 2020 and 2021. But the 2019 Derby drew more adoring spectators than ever before, many of whom are anticipating the Derby's triumphant return in 2022. The race is planned for August 20th, with a Roaring Twenties theme to celebrate the Kirby Derby's 20th anniversary, and kickstart another decade of races. The people of Kirby Street hope their creative momentum will carry through the whole triangle, inspiring others to celebrate their communities. I want to encourage other neighborhoods to do similar stuff. The Kirby Derby has really brought our neighborhood together, and it brings out our creativity, says Delano. What Raleigh needs is more parties, more creative parties, he says. This article was edited for Time. This University Park bonsai enthusiast's collection connects him to his past, in Deeply Rooted by Addie Ladner. Miloš Novák grew up in the village of Dolný Dobruč in Czechoslovakia. He spent much of his free time wandering the mountains nearby and the streams and forests that wrapped around them, fascinated by the shapes that Mother Nature had created in the larch and birch beech trees that grew alongside the cliffs. Born in the late 1970s and raised during the country's socialist regime, Nowak's family had little income and grew their own produce. He can still recall his hard-working father and grandfather's bountiful plots of carrots, tomatoes, and apple, plum, and pear trees, which he would help tend for production. I learned early on that you could control the growth of a tree and how to graft and prune just right, Nowak says. I learned from watching my dad, who learned from his dad. During high school, he'd bike 15 kilometers a day to work in construction, and one day discovered a nearby bonsai nursery. That's when I saw my first bonsai. A Japanese art form, bonsai are the product of growing miniature-sized plants, trees, and shrubs, typically around 12 inches tall, by vigilantly controlling their roots and branches. Nowak became fascinated by this unique and artful way to grow trees. At the nursery, he bought The Complete Book of Bonsai by Harry Tomlinson. From Tomlinson's book, he learned that there are two ways to get a bonsai. These diminutive plants can grow organically, trimmed or constrained by wind, animals, or difficult terrain. Or they can be slowly, carefully crafted by human hands. Pretty much any tree can be manipulated into a bonsai, a smaller version of itself, he says. Inspired by the forms and lines of these living works of art, he attempted his first one, a shimpaku juniper, an evergreen conifer native to Japan, at age 18. It wasn't perfect, but it was good. I just really enjoyed the process, he says, so he kept practicing. For Nowak, this intense hobby is both science and art. You've got to look at the tree and say, what is its potential? What about the foliage? What shape? It is an art. Gently exposing the roots over time, Nowak cultivates branches to grow at certain angles and grafts on new shapes, grafts on new branches to create different shapes. From wisteria to juniper to ficus to cypress, there are few plant species Nowak hasn't raised as bonsai. On some of his bonsai plants, you can see metal wrapped around branches and fresh patches of paste where Nowak sealed spots after removing branches or adding new ones. If I think a branch needs to go there, I'll find a way to graft a branch there, he says. He tends to his bonsai for at least an hour each day, and sometimes as many as three. The soil requires attention, too. It needs to be more porous than typical organic matter to allow for good drainage, since the bonsai will spend their lifespan in a shallow ceramic vessel. Nowak mines the plant's roots and how they interact with the vessel. With bonsai, the roots are more exposed, but they're still the tree's foundation, and you want a strong tree, he says. He's been working on one special bonsai, a petite Japanese maple, for 10 years. I'm proud of that one. Another on display is a tri-colored azalea. To create it, he grafted three different azaleas onto one plant. Now it displays dainty blooms in pink, red, and white. Though miniature, each of his bonsai is majestic, with winding roots, knobby edges, delicate leaves, and greenery of different shapes. Nowak houses most of his bonsai collection in a 5-by-40-foot wood pergola in the backyard of the University Park home he shares with his wife Lynn and their daughters Lita and Carly. Surrounding the bonsai arbor is a wealth of other lush plants, a full-size Japanese maple, rhododendron, evergreens, and Lynn's favorite, roses. But other than the roses, Lynn says, the lush garden is mostly her husband's doing. Let's face it, this is all Milos, she laughs. It comes naturally to him. He has this artistic side. The word bonsai has Japanese origins and loosely translates to plant in pot. But to Nowak, the petite plants are much more. This is art, he says, and just like where he came from, quote, this is a piece of me, end quote. This article was edited for Time. Next in the Nature Department, beach birds. Take a closer look at your Surfside Companions by Mike Dunn. We're lucky to have so many wonderful beaches in our state. And the same things that draw us to the coast, the ocean, sky, wind, and long stretches of sand, make it a haven for many other fascinating life forms. Among them is a wide variety of coastal birds. My fascination with these animals began when I worked as a district naturalist with North Carolina State Parks. My territory included the eastern third of the state, with such coastal gems as Hammocks Beach, Carolina Beach, and Jockey's Ridge. Part of my job included resource management, like protecting colonial water bird nesting sites on various beaches and spoil islands, the land built up by dredging canals, where many birds nest in groups ranging in size from a few pairs to thousands. One of my great thrills was cooperating with some research conducted by Dr. James Parnell out of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, that involved banding brown pelicans and royal terns with small metal leg bands. Our research permits gave us access to island nesting sites that were generally off limits to the public. Being surrounded by hundreds of birds in order to help conserve them is something I'll never forget. Now, every time I visit the coast, I enjoy watching and photographing the many birds that make it their home. Most beachgoers have watched at least a few of the more common species. The wind-up toys of the beach are the sanderlings, known for scurrying back and forth with the waves as they probe the sand for food. They can be seen any time of year, though there tend to be more in winter than summer. They don't nest here. Rather, they breed in the Arctic, then migrate 2,000 to 6,000 miles to their wintering sites, including our coast. We often seen with sanderlings are on the beach are willets, which are larger, grayish shorebirds that flash bold black and white under their wings when they fly. Willets are noisy, and they are one of the few shorebirds that nest in North Carolina. They often feed at the edge of the surf zone, grabbing delicacies like mole crabs as they move back and forth in the waves. Gulls are another noisy beach bird, and if you leave your food unattended, one may swoop in and steal a snack off your towel. One of the most common is the aptly named laughing gull. It's easily recognized by its black hood in summer and has a distinctive laugh-like call, often accompanied by a vigorous head toss. Egg and feather hunting in the late 1800s nearly exterminated laughing gulls from their nesting colonies in the northeastern United States. But protections like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918 helped this and many other species to recover. Today, laughing gulls may be the most abundant breeding coastal bird along the U.S. East Coast. It's hard not to notice brown pelicans. These large birds have wingspans reaching 6.5 feet. Plus, they have some eye-catching behaviors, like diving headfirst from heights of 20 to 60 feet above the ocean to gulp fish in their enormous expandable throats, called the gular pouch, or gliding over waves with ease, often in a group in an undulating line just above the water. This is another of our coastal birds that suffered tremendous population declines, this time in the mid-1900s, from high concentrations of pesticides that entered the marine food web. Brown pelicans were placed on the endangered species list, but with protections and the banning of certain pesticides, populations are doing well, with an estimated 4,000 to 5,000 nesting pairs now in our state. American oyster catchers are waders, seen at the beach or, more commonly, in the mud flats on the Sound side. They're one of the few birds that specialize in feeding on saltwater mollusks like oysters. An American oyster catcher will stab its flattened bill into a partially opened oyster and sever the muscles that hold the shell together so it can then eat the inner parts. Along with oyster catchers, you may see a lot of other interesting birds on the Sound side of your beach location. Large white waders will be great or snowy egrets or white ibis feeding in the marshes. A larger grayish bird could be a great blue heron. Overhead, you might see an osprey hovering before a feet-first dive for fish. And if you happen to be near the Pea Island National Wildlife Refuge on the Outer Banks, keep an eye out for two of my favorite small waders, the black-necked stilt. They have the second longest legs in proportion to body size of any bird. Only flamingos are greater. And the American avocet. You may see them wading in shallow water, swishing their upturned bills from side to side to capture aquatic invertebrates. Take some time to observe your fellow feathered beachgoers on your next beach trip. The more you know about them, the more you'll want to protect them. A few ways to help: respect nesting closures, keep your pets leashed, and don't litter. Your efforts will help ensure we can enjoy our amazing coastal birds far into the future. This article was edited for Time. From the Givers section, Tend and Mend, the Healing Place Courtyard offers a unique opportunity for recovery, by Catherine Curran. Within the Healing Place Courtyard, an earth-cast archway, by Thomas Sayre, marks one end of a gravel path. A rectangular monolith marks the other, and between them is a reflecting pool. All around is the lushness of summer. Jaunty zinnias, sunflowers, and cosmos stretching toward the sky. Tomato plants, heavy with fruit. Fragrant basil, bushy and full. The space is striking, but it serves a deeper purpose, offering both the work and the reward for those recovering from drug or alcohol addiction. At first, being a steward to the garden seemed like a strange way to spend time in recovery. I didn't see the similarities of the two, says Paul Keelan, a Healing Transitions alumnus. But today, I'm not sure I can see any of the differences. Water the plants, pull weeds, work hard, get dirty, enjoy the smells and sights all around you, and you'll reap rewards. The two are the same. The Healing Place Courtyard is part of Healing Transitions Men's Campus in Dorothea Dix Park. It's in the center of the organization's residential facilities, a peaceful refuge to reflect or congregate. Healing Transitions Executive Director Chris Budnick says that the outdoor space, which was created in the early 2010s, is now an integral piece of a participant's recovery. It can help through a number of things. It gives detox guests hope to look out and see program participants laughing and smiling, or offers a path forward when new participants interact with older participants and alumni in the courtyard, says Budnick. Slowing down and enjoying the present moment is a big one. This has many parallels with recovery and life, agrees Keelan, who spent 15 months in the program and is now almost 6 years into recovery. One of his jobs during the program was working as a scarecrow, managing the garden alongside volunteers from the North Carolina State Extension Master Gardeners of Wake County. Working with the Master Gardeners gave me a connection to folks outside of the recovery world, says Keelan. I was able to harvest the garden and prepare and serve the food that I grew to my fellow participants, which gave me a great sense of purpose and joy. Master Gardener Chris Clemens started volunteering at Healing Transitions in 2014 through the NC State Extension Program. I was excited to be a part of this initiative as my brother-in-law was suffering from substance abuse, says Clemens. I loved the idea of helping people that are working toward recovery learn gardening skills and the joy of growing your own food and flowers. The courtyard was designed by Sayre, who has said his earthcast sculptures are a metaphor for a healing path away from the stronghold of addiction. At one side of the space, there's a barrier-like structure, a monolith, that's in your way. We all have barriers in our life, Sayre says, but across from the barrier is an open door of opportunity. The closed door fits dimensionally within the open arch, but to get to that open door, you have to encounter the sections of Healing Transitions program. The space is both visually compelling and extremely functional. The words of the 12 steps of recovery line the walls, while nearby, tiered circular seating lends itself to gathering. Sayre, who creates his signature earth casts all over the world, says this is one of his most important projects. It's not always the case that I can work with a community that's so focused. The importance of their work made my work important. The sculpture in the garden can be seen from across the facility and accessed through a participant's journey with Healing Transition, says Budnick. The most significant piece of Thomas's design is it creates hope to be transmitted and for recovery to be cultivated, says Budnick. Sayre is pleased with how the garden has grown and incorporated his work over time. The gardeners have improved it vastly, tending to the space with care. While the Healing Place Courtyard is geared toward participants in Healing Transitions Recovery Program, it offers a reminder to all of the benefits of slow and steady work and being present in the moment. Gardening can be very meditative, and I think that's beneficial for all of us, not just those seeking recovery, says Clemens. It can be hard work, so there's the discipline of doing something for the good of all the participants. It's very rewarding to see people eating the vegetables you harvested for lunch or to see the flowers you grew on the dining room tables. Keelan, who still attends meetings in the courtyard, says gardening can teach us so many things about life in general as well as recovery. While in addiction, everything is about instant gratification and going a million miles an hour. But here, the process of keeping a neat, weed-free environment for the plants reminds me that I need to weed out the static and unwanted, untrue thoughts in my mind. Here, I can cultivate a healthy space within myself. And from the vault, meet the monsters. Life Before Dinosaurs exhibit highlights the creatures that preceded dinosaurs by Hampton Williams Hoffer. The second floor of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences is full of monsters. Saber-toothed mammals the size of bears, dragonflies with 2-foot wingspans, and land predators with massive sail-like fins. These species all dominated planet Earth some 290 million years ago, part of the ancient group called Permian monsters that thrived before the largest mass extinction in our planet's history wiped them out. The dinosaurs, who get a lot more airtime, then took their place. The Permian monsters are the stars of Life Before Dinosaurs, a special exhibition at the museum through September 4th that features full-scale interactive models of the creatures, like a motion-activated model of Titanophonius that turns its head and opens its mouth to reveal powerful bone-cracking canines. With shadow play from LED lights and realistic greenery, it's like stepping into another world. Dr. Christian Kammerer, the museum's research curator of paleontology, has traversed the globe hunting Permian fossils and has discovered numerous rare specimens. The Life Before Dinosaurs exhibit is especially meaningful to Kammerer in that it has made his work in obscure prehistoric life more accessible to the general public. Hopefully, Kammerer says, visitors come away with an appreciation for the diversity and majesty of some of these creatures. Our current change in global climate are unprecedented in human history, so we should be looking into the deep past for equivalents. Kammerer hopes that the exhibit will be a call to action, an opportunity to reformulate how people understand existence on our planet, and the way life has evolved, and what lies ahead. This article was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.